your favorite cartoon characters will help you understand how drugs and alcohol can ruin your life. So watch the program. Talk about it with your family.
Make the right
presentation with Mike and Ethan, or
Elf will not be seen tonight.
You know, we watch a lot more documentaries on this show than I was kind of expecting to, but you know, it becomes, when you're in search of comic strips that don't get talked about much, then you know, because they don't have any kind of adaption, it tends to be the place that you know you find something about them. I was not expecting to see Mel Lazarus today, but here he was, and a whole lot of others, on the folks behind the Funnies.
Yeah, so this is a 2018 documentary about the creative geniuses behind some of the most beloved newspaper comic strips of the last half of the 20th century, in a poignant tribute. I'm actually surprised this is so recent. I assumed this was actually a much older documentary.
Because it seems to have taken a very long time to get made.
Yeah, because it wasn't... I was looking at this and I was like, wait, how are all these people still alive in 2018? I mean, I thought Mel Lazarus wasn't around anymore in 2018, was he?
I think he died in 2018, yeah. And also we have Bill Keen, who died in 2011.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought that was... And Mort Walker was in this, too. And I don't think... And he was... I believe he died in 2018 as well. So...
That's right. Also featured here... Yeah, in 2018? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, 2018 was not a good year for the Funnies pages. We lost a lot, apparently. But we did get this documentary, so... it is... It's definitely weird to think that this was made in 2018 because by 2018, the comics page, does it still exist in any way? I don't really think it, not like it used to.
I don't know about you, but my newspaper is no longer daily. They run like, they have a Monday episode. They have a Monday, a Wednesday, a Friday, and a Sunday.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
No, it's not. I mean, do you still draw your comic every day in that event? Do they double up when you're like, here are your two family circuses?
Yeah, we had a weekly here in my town that, well, we have two papers. We have the local daily that nobody reads and nobody's ever read, because you basically, you know, you pay money so they can tell you that, like, oh, you know, the gays are, you know, let me tell you what the queers are doing to the soil, you know. so nobody actually reads it. It exists, I think, as some sort of money laundering operation. And then we have a weekly, you know, alternative weekly. And that's like, hey, you want to know where the latest soy mart is? Soy market? Mark swap? Here we go. And that went monthly during pandemic. And as soon as that happened, it's like, well, that's not going to last long. And then I think last month they were like, guess what? We're online only now. And it's like, well,
yep.
Been nice knowing you. That's the state of American journalism, because, you know, as we know, the newspaper has been a dying beast for the last 20 years, and it's finally time to put a bullet in its head, take it out of its misery, because we don't need it anymore. Newspapers are gone. All there is now is, like, they exist to launder some billionaires' genocide. That's all they do now. You can't even read the comics in them anymore. Where do people get comics? In the newspaper?
I guess at the comics website. You know, I've heard people complain about, you know, it's nice to have comics, you know, it's nice to have comics at the click of a button, but it's what I liked was having a giant wall of them in front of you so you could peruse and browse, and I don't really care about that, honestly.
I mean, I'm not like, Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I guess the thing is, like, with when you go to a website and you click on, you know, to look at a comic, I think there's a big difference between a comic strip from the newspaper and a web comic, because web comics are kind of designed to be read in that way, where they get more serialized, you have longer story arcs, so you'll sit there and just click through them and you can read them for hours. Whereas a daily strip, it's like, it's usually just a gag. And after you read about five or six in a row, you're like, oh, it turns out this isn't very good, you know?
Yes.
So they're designed to be read one at a time, so you don't notice that they're actually not very good. So yeah, forcing people to read them on the websites, I think, probably hurts your daily comic strip, your newspaper comic strip. But I mean, what else are you going to do? Go, I guess now the whole thing is you got to make them, well, you know what? Whatever. It is what it is. But this 2018 documentary is like a fun little romp down memory lane, because you get to meet all the big names from the late 20th century. You know, people that were mostly after, I think, you know, just at the cusp of when I grew too old to read the comics, you know. Because we got like the Pearls Before Swine guy, we got Get Fuzzy guy, and those guys, you know, I mean, those are guys who like I know of, you know, but like I never really followed them the way I followed earlier comics because I was too old. But we also get some classics, because we do get like Mort Walker from Beetle Bailey, we get Lynn Johnson from For Better For Worse, we get a wide cross range of different people who worked in late 20th century and early 21st century comics as a medium. And I think it was interesting in some ways.
I think it's, you know, I think it could have been better, because mostly it's just the cartoonists talking. It would be nice if we had like, you know, a question and answer session, or maybe some stuff that was like, you know, giving you some background on this comic, that's not necessarily from the creator's perspective. But other than that, yeah.
Like, I think that's the thing is, like, honestly, what is said is mostly not interesting, because mostly the different cartoonists talking about how, you know, praising each other.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, of course,
Chris Brown is just the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, you know, it's like you're going to, it's like he's the most kindest, most, you know, they're all Manchurian candidating it, but they're all friends.
Nobody talks about Scott Adams.
I did notice that. but like, you know, in general, I assume it's a small community and like they don't badmouth each other, at least not publicly. So I'm not surprised. But I do think some of the things that they said about cartooning as a business and as a calling were kind of interesting to hear, because I think in general the most interesting is just that they do all kind of have a very at least all the ones they talk to seem to have a very accurate understanding of their role as cartoonists. You know,
they understand that, you know, you only have someone's attention for 5 seconds a day.
Yes. And, you know, they mostly understand, like, look, we're not changing the world. We're making people chuckle, you know. They also, you know, so they understand what, you know, their role is. They're not, you know, getting big heads about it. But at the same time, you can see that they do take that, you know, that relatively, you know, minor thing that they're doing, they do take it very seriously and treat it as, you know, an art form. So that's, you know, very interesting. I think that's probably true, a human thing, where no matter what you do, you know, we take what we do seriously and we treat it as like, you know, we treat it with the respect that a craftsman is due.
Absolutely. I would hate to think that, you know, actually, no, I would love to think that everyone could have a job that they take as much pride in as these cartoonists do. I mean, I would much rather go to the restaurant where somebody puts as much into my hamburger as, say, Mort Walker does into Beetle Bailey.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those things where, you know, when you're outside of that community, you know, to some degree, it might seem kind of silly, you know, but yeah. I think there is something very, like, you know, very human and admirable about that, you know, like if you get, and it's something everyone does, like, you know, if you get like, you know, if you have like a bunch of, I don't know, like, you know, like you said, if a guy's a hamburger makers and it's like, okay, obviously they're going to know like, okay, look, this guy's the best. He's the best at making hamburgers, you know, and here's the tricks to doing it right. And here's like what I've learned, you know, by making hamburgers my, you know, lifetime. And I'm going to put that skill into it. So, you know, it's like there's no small jobs, just small people, as they say. But, you know, I mean, definitely, I think like, you know, if you've ever, you know, but I think it's interesting to see because it's not just that they, you know, it's cartooning is a job that is done to some degree in isolation. You know, you're just drawn, mm-hmm. but it's also interesting to see how it works as like as a community, you know, because obviously these are all people who know each other and admire each other's work. And, you know, you can see in the way they talk about each other's work that, you know, they can, you know, they are experts at this thing and they understand the nuances of cartooning that like a lay person reading these comics probably wouldn't pick up on, you know, like when they were discussing Hank Ketcham. Right. And they were talking about his line work. And, you know, I've read Dennis the Menace. I've seen it my whole life and I've never really stopped to look at it. But like when they were talking about that and then they were showing Dennis the Menace comics, I was looking at it. I was like, you know, it's right. He does have very fine line work. And it's yes. very interesting to see how he actually draws Dennis the Menace. It is very stylized, but at the same time, you know, very easy to parse, very easy to tell what all these things are, you know?
He does like great line weights. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, and also, you know, very abstract, but also very expressive, you know, like yeah. when Mr. Wilson makes a face, you know what that face is. You
yeah,
know?
It's not a, you know, it's not hidden behind his mustache.
Yes.
He is not, Mr. Wilson is not just an icon. He is, you know, he has a functional anatomy, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure, you know, cartoonists being what they are, I know that, that what's his name? Mitchell? No, that's Dennis's mm-hmm. last name. Shit. No, why?
Hank Ketcham.
Hank Ketcham. I know that Hank Ketcham has nude art of every single one of the characters. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, you yeah. can tell by the way he draws Alice. He's like, this is a hot woman.
Yeah, this is a hot woman based on my first wife that I may have killed.
Is that true?
Well, that might be going a little to be. Making a little too heavy of an assumption, but basically, his wife died. And then he, like a week later, he married his mistress and dropped Dennis off in a, military school on his birthday.
Boy, they sure left a lot out of this documentary.
They sure did. Who was the menace?
Wow. Damn. So there's a dark side to Hank Ketcham that but you wouldn't know it from listening to all these other people. Everyone's like, oh, he's the best. He's so great. Hank Ketcham.
Yes. I mean, and he's dead, so they can't really, you know, talk bad about him right here. So
yeah, that's true. He's no longer with us. So that does remind me. I do remember seeing like some I do remember vaguely seeing when I was younger, one of those like the real story of Dennis, you know, and interviewing the adult Dennis about his father. And I don't remember because I was like 14 when I saw that, but I do remember it was it seemed that Dennis did not have an easy childhood.
No, I mean, there was that. And then there was the fact that, of course, he went to Vietnam and came back like, you know, addicted to amphetamines and shit. So
wow. Well, you know, the real menace is imperialist warfare, honestly.
That's right.
But yeah. Wow. So, Dennis kind of got a raw deal. It sounds like,
I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, and I don't know if, you know, his, You know, I don't know how much we can blame on his father, but it does seem very suspicious how quickly that marriage went through.
Yeah, I mean, well, consider, yeah, it's also considering that, like, what Henry and Alice are based on, yeah, Hank and his first wife, I do feel like the Dennis the Menace movie that we watched recently, there's definitely a lot of fodder there that they could have brought in, but they probably wisely decided, let's not keep this G-rated. We're not going to have this all be about, like,
his, turns out Switchblade Sam was the original Dennis.
Well, but you know, the point being that he's good at drawing lines. Good at drawing lines.
Very much so.
Yeah. But, you know, good at drawing lines, possibly good at murdering wives. Who are we to say? You know, it's not for us. Let Hank Ketchum be judged by a jury of his peers. And his peers say his line weight is great.
They sure do.
But, like, you know, he's not the only person who is who gets mentioned in this. We have who else do we have in this documentary?
Okay, we have, you know, one of our first stars, Mel Lazarus, talking to us. Mel Lazarus looks like, I don't know, the host of Mystery or something. And
I could not get over. He looks so 1970s. He looks like, because when I saw him, it's like, he looks like he should be running a projection, the projector on, like, you know, a 42nd Street grindhouse theater.
You're right. He looks just like Wally from Mission Hill.
Yeah. He also, I don't know if this is fair. He definitely, when he was talking, I was like, he's got a very, like, Stan Lee kind of starfucker quality to him, which I would not have expected from everything that I've heard of Mel Lazarus, but, like, you know,
I haven't heard that much about Mel Lazarus, apart from that he is in Mensa, and Mama is based on his own relationship with his mother, and his mother loved Mama because he thought he'd based it on her sister.
Oh, that's funny. I mostly know he's in Mensa because they mentioned on The Simpsons.
Yeah, it's true. He
and
was.
They're like yeah, and it's like they're all tops in their field. Maybe not Mel Lazarus. Well, you know, I guess here's the thing of Mel Lazarus. I don't like to speak ill of the dead, right? There's nothing
I don't
in
know
this
if I'd
documentary
say that about you, but
that
okay.
Well, you know, I'll still do it. No, but, like, nothing in this documentary suggests anything bad about Mel Lazarus. Everyone has only good things to say about him. Mel Lazarus, I'm just going to say it, is like, I do not believe that Mel Lazarus ever really had any sort of organic popularity among the populace. Not the way that, like, Dennis the Menace or Peanuts did. I feel like Mel Lazarus, but Mel Lazarus was one of those people, because he even says it, that he kind of came into comics right at the end of the Golden Age. So as, you know, Milt Caniff and all the Golden Age guys were just kind of making their exits. And so he kind of, I think there was, you know, he was there at a time when there was an open niche and he kind of got in it. And, you know, he's fine. You know, and he produced a comic strip that was fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with Mama or Miss Peach. No. I don't think they're terrible comics. They're comics that, like, you read and you immediately forget them, you know, so, which makes them kind of like platonic ideals for comic strips.
Right.
You know? So in a sense, he's very, very good at his job. You might say he is top in his field because he understands what the art form is about. It is about a sensible chuckle that you immediately forget so that you can read the exact same joke tomorrow and have the same sensible chuckle. So he's very good at that, and you can see why everyone in comics respects him so much. But that's respect of fellow artists who can see what he's doing and understand what he's doing and appreciate it. The populace in general, I don't think, would appreciate what he was doing. They would have the sensible chuckle and then immediately forget. And so I feel like, so he's definitely someone who can, like, be in the newspaper for, like, 50 years and do a fine career. But I cannot imagine anyone going out and buying, like, a Mama collection, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to an awful lot of used bookstores. I've never seen a Best of Mama collection.
Yeah. And I also feel like, in the days before it was easy to quantify like audience reaction, you know, like before there was an internet, so you could immediately know how much people like or hate something. The networks and the studios are like, all right, we want to make something. We don't know what to make. What do we do? Well, Mama, it's a pre-existing property. It's been in the newspaper for 50 years. People know it. People probably like that. So you get like all these Miss Peach adaptations that we've seen, like the one with the puppets. It was on, what was that thing we just watched? Curiosity Shop. Yeah. But I don't feel like, you know, I feel like nobody was actually that interested in seeing a Miss Peach adaptation. People were just like, oh yeah, it's that thing I remember, you know? And they stuck it in there because they're like, yeah, people remember this. So, good on Mel Lazarus for getting that bag, but I don't feel like, I don't know. I feel like Mel Lazarus is like, yeah, the top craftsman of the field, but not like the top artist of the field, if that makes sense.
No, like, I mean, his artwork is so loose and balloon like and almost a scribble a lot of the time. There's no real detail to it. He just creates he just has a line on the side of the panel for a house. And then Mama herself is literally just a head wearing a dress. I wonder how many people were disappointed because they thought the movie Big Mama's House was based on the comic strip.
Oh my God. Can you imagine all the mama stands getting, like, where's Mrs. Hobbs? Where's Francis? Whoa, our money back. How dare you? They see Martin Lawrence. Like, I can't believe Mama's gone woke. Oh man. But that is the thing is, yeah, Mel Lazarus. So like, he's good at making comics. He understands, he understands the assignment, but he doesn't, he's not going to be the comic that captures the audience's passion, you know?
No, there's like not someone who's like, wait, you know, why didn't you publish Mama in today's comic? I don't care if she said something mean about Reagan.
Actually, that does bring up another interesting thing that they mention in this documentary though. And they do talk about, you know, the comics business, how competitive it is, right?
And the comics business, well, famously, Lynn Johnson said that they say there's no competition in this business, but Bill Watterson is making us all work a lot harder.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like I kind of knew this, but I hadn't thought about it before. But I think it's Stephen Pastis who says, like, there's limited real estate, so every time that you get your comic in a newspaper, by definition, you have to knock someone else's comic out.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So it is, you know, it's, I guess once you're in the club, they seem very genteel to each other, but it does seem extremely cutthroat, you know?
Yeah. That is why everyone has kind of mixed feelings about Charles Schulz. Because of course he's, you know, the grandfather of their whole civilization and was, you know, a loving and devoted, you know, second father to so many of them. Lynn Johnson, again, she used to draw her, for better or for worse, comics on the backs of old peanut strips that he gave her. But then he died and he's been dead for 25 years and his comic is still running in papers. Think how many people could be getting their comic published if that wasn't given over to old peanutses.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, talk about your American gerontocracy. That's kind of the ultimate of that. Cause you know, I mean, I blow hot and cold on peanuts, but like, I do have to Dan Pizarro of Bizarro. I do have to agree that, like, yeah, Charles Schulz pretty much invented modern cartooning as an art form. You know, everyone standing on his shoulders. That is absolutely true. That said, I mean, it's as important as Peanuts is as a historical document. Yeah, why is it should not be in the paper anymore? Because first of all, it is taking up real estate that, like, you know, new cartoonists, living cartoonists should have to tell new stories that, you know, appeal to a new generation. Because, like, Peanuts, it's kind of timeless, but at the same time, it is very much rooted in a world that no longer exists. And you know, it's like, look, you're not going to run bringing up Father in the paper anymore, right? You're not going to do, like, Mutt and Jeff. Sure, they were important for the history of cartooning, but, like, you don't pick up the newspaper and read the comics page for a fucking history lesson, you know? What? That's like, oh,
did
great.
Did bringing
like
up Father finally end? I thought it was still going.
Oh, is it still going? Oh, my God.
It ended in it ended in 2000. Okay, good, because I remember... God,
what?
The first place I ever saw bringing up Father was when it was post. They shared a strip from it in Simpsons Illustrated. You remember Simpsons Illustrated, the Simpsons magazine that was quarterly? Yeah. It was great.
Yes.
and there was a bringing up Father strip where a couple of women are looking at Jigs and they go, "Oh, he looks just like that glamorous Hollywood star." And he's like, "Oh, which one do you mean? Bart Simpson." Like, first of all, no, he fucking doesn't. He doesn't look anything like Bart Simpson. He looks like a beagle boy. But
wow. Bart Simpson. Yeah, he does not look like Bart Simpson.
He doesn't look even close to Bart Simpson. But yeah, there's... So yeah, Jigs was... Yeah, they were still making Maggie and Jigs into 1990 and into 2000. But I guess you're right. They did finally stop after...
Well,
how many different authors did it have? Just one? Just the one guy?
Wait, how long did he live?
God, he ran it from 1913 to 2000. It ran for 87 years.
Wait,
I'm not seeing a list of who actually drew it besides George McManus.
Wait, but it can't be the same guy, because unless he started drawing it literally the moment he was born and, like, just drew it for eight and died, like, you know, at 80. Because otherwise, how does that work?
Nah, who was drawing Bringing Up Father in 1990? Well, it says his brother was an uncredited script collaborator, but he died in 1941. Good God.
Okay. A lot of mysteries going on here with this Bringing Up Father.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize we were going to bring up so much about Bringing Up Father. Oh, okay. Okay, so Bringing Up Father... Okay, it was High Eastman. Wait, no. No, they can't tell you who did it. Jeez. Yeah, okay. They say that, you know, the last artist that Wikipedia lists, they say, wasn't able to continue. And so it said, Bringing Up Father limped along until its 87-year run came to a close on May 28th, 2000. Yeah, but who was limping it along?
Okay. Wow. Just a literal zombie comic strip. It just everyone who made it was dead. It just kept going by itself.
It more like brains up, Father.
It would not die. That is that is kind of bizarre and incredible, but I feel like we're going to have to look at bringing up Father at some point. But
I'm sure that must have had some kind of adaption at some point.
I'm sure it's got like Blondie. It's probably got like about 100 shitty like movies from like the 30s, you know?
Yeah. Oh boy. I can't wait to watch Bringing Up Baby with Bringing Up Father.
But the point also stands, like, I guess zombie comics are nothing new. You know, they've been doing this for years, but Bringing Up Father by 2000, I'm sure was not in very many newspapers.
Oh no.
And I feel like probably Peanuts will eventually have the same inglorious end where it just gradually fades out as it become, as, you know, generation after generation finds less and less to relatable in the follies of Peanuts, which, you know, I mean, is the way of the world. That's the way things are. It's not a slam on Peanuts. Obviously, nothing has staying power forever. But I feel like, yeah, you really should just end it. And, you know, it's the cartoonists that they interview in this documentary, they all, almost all of them basically say when they're talking about their strips, they are not really there to be funny. That is not the main point. The main point is to be relatable. And that's pretty much true, you know, because they have to be, it's the broad audience, the mass audience, they have to be all things to all people. And you can't really be funny that way, you know, not like really funny. You're very limited in how funny you can be. So instead, your job is to be relatable, so people can kind of look at it and be like, that's the truth. And they kind of, you know, they connect with it that way. So so all the cartoonists basically say that. And, you know, that's why, again, Charles Schulz and Peanuts is as successful as this, because people really relate to the very, you know, the timeless human drama of Charlie Brown. Which, you know, and they still do to some degree, because, you know, people can still recognize things in Charlie Brown and Snoopy, even in the year of our Lord 2024. But, you know, again, it is a different time, and time moves on, and eventually people are going to be like, I don't understand why this dog wants to drive a Zamboni, you know?
Yeah, I've wondered if maybe you could run Peanuts and Snoopy as two different strips by just having the strips where Snoopy is just sitting around on his doghouse, and then just having the ones where Charlie Brown and his friends are doing their thing.
It's going to be like Slimer and the real Ghostbusters. So just have Snoopy and the real Peanuts.
The real Peanuts. Oh, wow. What's Filmation's Peanuts?
You know, when they got like, this is when Charlie Brown was hanging out with a gorilla.
Yes. Charlie Brown and Linus and a gorilla, and they always fight the same villains, and they have this like 15-minute transformation sequence they do every strip. It takes up the whole middle panel.
It's just like, let's go, Peanuts. Let's go. Yeah. So Peanuts, that's, and again, like, you know, in this, documentary, what's his face? The Bizarro guy,
Dan Peraro.
Dan Peraro. He says he's used to hate Peanuts, and he has become a big Peanuts booster, which, you know, is fair. I definitely think that, like, when you're older, you can appreciate more of what Charles Schulz was doing instead of just being, why is this old man still around? But I do disagree when he says that, like, people say, why is Peanuts still in the paper? And he makes this big argument that, like, Peanuts should be in the paper because of the great debt that modern cartooning owes to Charles Schulz. And it's like, I don't agree with that at all.
I don't think that Schulz would agree with that.
Yeah, I feel like it's like, I'm sorry, but, like, it is eventually all things must end. You know, that is the way Peanuts will, things must eventually, you know, change is scary, but all flesh is mortal, you know? So, I don't think, Peanuts should be forever there to make as some sort of history lesson so that we can all appreciate like the art of cartooning. Yeah. Sorry. That's silly.
So many of them, you know, we think of Peanuts as just being this thing that exists on its own, but so much of it is built on on the times in America and the things that were happening, the stuff with Snoopy going to the moon, the stuff where Snoopy was going to be the first beagle to break Babe Ruth's record, and he was going to beat Hank Aaron to it, and all the mentions of Sam Snead. Who the hell is Sam Snead?
Well, you know, it's probably very big in Peanuts times.
Yeah. He was a golfer.
Oh, man. So, like, what? Let's see. Which cartoonist do we actually see in this documentary?
Let's see. We are introduced at the very start to, let's see, we get, let's look at it in the order that they are introduced. First of all, we have Chris Brown, the late Chris Brown. We lost him last year. Second author of Hagar the Horrible after his father, Dick Brown. Yeah.
Wait, so Chris Brown just died?
Yeah, he died. He was 70. So this was a while ago. He doesn't look 70 here.
Oh, my God.
He looks pretty good, actually. But actually, he looks very thin here because, you know, Dick Brown was a big man, but Chris Brown was a big man. He was like 500 pounds. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because in the documentary, he does not look 500 pounds.
No, I've seen interviews with him where, you know, he's got those kind of those big legs going on when you have a really serious weight problem. So I wonder if that might have had something to do with his death. But he died at age 70 and his father died of cancer at age 71. So,
oh, geez.
So it might have been the same cause. I don't know.
Oh, that's unfortunate. He does not look that old in this.
No,
because
he honestly looks like one of our peers.
Yeah, because this is from, like, again, came out in 2018. He looks, I'd say, yeah, like in his 40s.
Yeah.
But because, yeah, he's barely got any gray in the beard. He looks really good, honestly. So yeah. Knowing that he's like actually like he's like Flanders. So, wow. But yeah, so yeah, we don't have him around anymore. So is Hager still going? Hager is
still
going.
Yeah, there is a new cartoonist doing Hagar. So once again, that's a gap that should be filled, but is still being held onto.
Yeah, I mean, I think this documentary is interesting because we do meet a few times where like there are a few cartoonists who like introduce us to the like Bill Keane and Jeff Keane. So
yeah,
he's going on about like it's good to kind of the next generation taking over, and it's like I can kind of see why, like especially there's so few things in this world anymore where you can give, you know, that gift to your children of, you know, like it used to be like, I've got this like farm, well, it'll be yours someday, and nowadays there's so few things like that, so it's kind of touching in a way to see like cartoonists be like, this will be my, you know, this will all be yours someday. But at the same time, it's like, do we really need some of these comics to be around forever? Wouldn't it be good if the kids could, if they want to do comics, come up with their own, I don't know, or make it their own in some way? Because
it
can be done.
You can make an argument for maybe the newspapers should run comics in kind of like the way colleges have legacy admissions. Like, you know, we're going to give you a special chance because we know that you learned at your dad's feet, that kind of thing. But,
yeah,
at the same time, yeah, Jeff does do Family Circus full time for the last, you know, 13 years. So,
I mean, I think it's interesting because, like, obviously some of them and they basically just do like, here's more of the same here. I learned from my dad exactly how to do this comic and that's how we're going to do it. And we have seen some comics where a new person takes over and they really make it their own, you know, like,
Nancy,
like, I can't remember the names, but you know, Nancy or, Sally,
the
Ford.
New Mark Trail. Yeah. And,
yes.
The new, as it's called, Popeye and Olive.
Mm. Yeah. So it can be done. I do think that probably like they do mention in this that like, you don't have the luxury of really building an audience anymore in comics. You have to like come out immediately and be popular or you're gone. So I can understand that like if you've been gifted a legacy strip, you would probably be very reluctant to change anything in it because if it goes wrong, you've basically just killed the golden goose, you know?
Right. I mean, so we've talked a lot about the transformation of Heathcliff and that was very gradual.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I guess if I was gifted a legacy strip, you know, and I was doing it, maybe, you know, gradually it does become your own. You kind of change it to me, you know, very gradually to reflect your own sensibilities, or maybe it changes you, you know, to the point where you're like, well, you kind of gaslight yourself into thinking like, this is what I always wanted to do. The exact same thing as my dad. Who knows? who knows? But anyway, so Chris Brown is in this. Who else do we got?
Stephen Pastis of Pearls Before Swine, looking much younger in this than he did in the Calvin and Hobbes documentary.
Stephen Pastis is funny because every time he's on screen, I just think he's one of those, like, it's like, oh my God, a wizard brought like a homie's action figure to life.
Yeah, he looks like the kids in the hall playing a character.
Yeah, he's not what I would have expected, you know, somehow.
Yeah, well, he draws himself looking much more schlubby, but
that's true, because he actually looks rather, I don't know, he's kind of got Riz, yeah, as the kids say.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, when you look at old Too Much Coffee Man comics, and Shannon Wheeler draws himself as this, you know, hideous hunchbacked thing with this lunk jaw full of teeth like a broken cash register.
Well, you know, when I was younger, I always thought, like, that's what you should do. You should always draw yourself uglier than you really are, so that, like, when people meet you in real life, they're like, dang, you're actually a fox, you know?
Oh, shit. Oh, well, I'll start drawing myself ugly.
Yeah. The thing is, now that I'm old and ugly in real life, I'm like, well, I don't like that. I'm going to start drawing wish fulfillment pictures. Yeah. Anyway, then we get Jerry Scott from Baby Blues and Zits. And honestly, he looks exactly how I would have expected.
Kind of looks like Colin Mochrie.
Yeah. He's got this, like, extremely dad quality to him that I was like, yeah, that kind of scans, you know?
Yeah, he looks like he's about to say no homework. Or no, yeah, no, yeah. Pizza until you finish your homework.
Let's see. Then we got,
Rick Stramosky of Soup to Nuts. I have never heard of Soup to Nuts.
I have also never heard of Soup to Nuts. And I think that's probably why we get very little of him in this documentary, to be honest.
Yeah. Maybe he was new at the time.
Yeah, maybe this was, you're right, he's probably a new up-and-comer, and let's see, did he last? Because they said it's Soup to Nuts. It's hard to last. Well, it looks like it is still running. Oh, no, it's not. It started
in 2000. Oh, it ended in 2018. Okay.
Again, apparently 2018 was a very bad year for comics.
Man.
Wow. So that's kind of, I mean, that, I don't know, that I feel like that would be a little weird that, like, hey, guess what? The documentary you're in just about as a cartoonist just came out just in time for your comic strip to end.
Yeah. Maybe that's why they finally kicked it out the door in 2018.
They're like, oh, you know, we better do this sooner. People are going to start wondering, like, literally we're all the comics in this are they're either going to be, they're all going to be like either dead or canceled. We need to get this out the door. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Rick Stromboli here. He basically looks like Guy Fieri.
Yeah,
like, he looks like, yeah, he should be driving like, hey, it's me, Rick Stromboli. We're gonna be looking at some drivers, divins, and dinosaurs this week. Yeah. I don't know.
it looks like Joey from Full House.
Oh, he totally does. He's got that, like, he's whoa, Uncle Joey.
And then we have Scott Adams. Yes.
So Soup to Nuts. Oh, Scott Adams. Yes. What a nerd. Scott Adams,
he comes across as pretty normal in this. And that's another way that you can tell this is from a long time ago.
Yeah. Scott Adams is an interesting character, as we know.
Yes. We all well know what a character Scott Adams is at this point, but, you know, he came across as relatively normal at this point, apart from his kind of weird, crooked smile that keeps disturbing me.
Yeah. Scott Adams, he looks like, I mean, I guess it makes sense. He's an engineer, you know? So every time I see him, I just imagine he looks like, okay, look, if you were watching a movie about, like, how NASA did something in the 60s, he looks like someone who should be in that movie. You know,
he looks like James Carville.
Yep. I can see it. He just looks like a nerd. He's not really in this documentary a lot.
No,
they only kind of come to him a couple times.
They must have had to cut out a lot of his rants.
Well, I did notice a couple things about Scott Adams in this documentary. One is, you know, like he can't resist going on a rant about how he's, you know, political correctness gone mad is canceling him. Though, you know, because he says you do a comic and like you get angry letters all the time. And the thing is, he brings up some examples that are 100% not real. Like he made that up. Because yes. He says, like, he did some comic about eating a unicorn, and he got angry letters from unicorn lovers, and it's like, no, you didn't, man. You did not. I 100% do not believe that happened. You did not get a single letter from an angry unicorn lover, because it just doesn't exist. Come on. Come on. You know?
I don't know. Maybe you got a letter from Dana Simpson.
Oh, yeah, but she wasn't around in 2018. This is before her time. she wasn't born until like 2019. She's about 5 years old. I don't know. And then he says that like he made some comic strip about leprechauns and the Irish got mad at him. And it's like, I don't feel like that actually happened either. I mean, I feel like you're just making this up because, you know, you want to be persecuted. So, and you want to make it look like you are being, you know, like, oh, people are so mean to me. They're getting mad at me for all these wacky reasons that don't make sense. And it's like, yeah, they don't make sense because you clearly just made them up, man. I suppose in 2018 or before that, those were kind of, you know, like those are kind of harmless things that he's saying. But like, we all know how that snowballed. And today he's all like, yeah, the blacks and the Jews are trying to cancel me all the time. It's like, okay, man. Because he's like one of the few, like, otherwise most people in, like, almost everyone else in this documentary is, like, relentlessly positive.
Yeah.
You know? And Scott Adams is basically, when they come to him, he's like, he's complaining about getting canceled. And then he has that other thing where he's, like, I guess they ask, like, what gives you hope for the future or something? And he says... And he basically says most children are stupid and terrible, but occasionally you meet a good one. And it's like, all right. And then he kind of like, well, then they kind he kind of like damns Kathy with faint praise. But like, I also feel like in general, this documentary is like kind of a little mean to Kathy.
Yes, he is overly dismissive of Kathy. It's very much a, it's a girl thing, but girls can like it if they want to.
I mean, it's fair that he's not into it, but he's also like, the way he says it, it's just like, yeah, it's like, oh, it's for girls, you know? It's just like, come on, man. I mean, I admit, like, this was kind of my attitude to Kathy when I was younger, but like, as an adult, you know, I can see the merit in Kathy. You know,
absolutely. Yeah, me too.
And I would think as a fellow cartoonist, he should too. But Scott Adams is a weird thing because I feel like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I noticed most of these cartoonists, they would, when they focused on the cartoon, they would have other cartoonists like talking and praising that one. They didn't have anyone saying anything about Scott Adams.
Yeah. Know? No one had any like, oh, Scott Adams, just the nicest guy. Scott Adams, he gave you the shirt off his back. Scott Adams, he was the best man at my wedding. Like, no, Scott Adams, we just kind of have to stay out of his way when we do the yearly meetings.
Well, I also wonder, cause like, you know, obviously they're not going to say anything bad. I don't, you know, they're not going to air dirty laundry or anything. And I really don't know what anyone's feelings about Scott, you know, in the cartooning community are, but I'm thinking, you know, like you're privately, if I were a cartoonist, right.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about how, you know, you have professional pride in what you do, right. Even if it's a dumb comic, you have some pride of craftsmanship in it. And, I think, like, you know, when you look at comics, you can kind of appreciate, you know, if you are a cartoonist, you can kind of appreciate the artistry that goes into it, even if it's artistry that, like, the average layperson wouldn't pick up on. Like, I think the average layperson would look at, like, Kathy or The Far Side and be like, oh, the art sucks. And it's kind of true. They're not good artists, you know? No. like Gary Larson can barely draw. Kathy Jisowitz can barely draw. But I think if you look, read the comics and take them as comics, you kind of appreciate, oh, I can see how, you know, they use the art in order to kind of make to make the joke, you know, how they kind of complement each other, how they work. And, you know, Gary Larson can like make a comic, you know, make a Far Side panel with no dialogue and you can totally understand it. You can parse and get it. Right.
Hillary Price talks about this when they're talking to her. She says, I stop drawing when the joke is told.
And I think
that's a good way to keep it.
Yeah, like she's another good example. If you look at her art objectively, it's not that good. You know, it's just, you know, doodles. But like she, it works for what she's doing. And the thing with Scott Adams, though, is his art is so stilted.
Yes.
And he has so little interest in doing anything visually in his comic. And his writing, I mean, you know, I feel like peak Dilbert, there was something there. Like, I don't think it was entirely bad. I think he actually had some really clever things that he abandoned because he decided to just do all office humor.
Yeah.
And,
you know, when Dilbert got started, when it was badly drawn, Bloom County Part 2, then I was into it. You know, when you had, you know, the stuff like Bob the Dinosaur and Phil the Prince of Insufficient Light, that was all great. But, you know, and then was he just courting the office demographic, or did he run out of ideas?
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, I think that is kind of the tragedy of Dilbert, is that, like, even though it's, you know, it's early Dilbert, you can kind of see potential. And now if you look at Dilbert, it's like, he has not improved in drawing at all.
No.
Like, he doesn't seem to have any interest in trying to improve or challenge himself artistically. And that, not just in the drawing, but also the writing, which has gotten not only has gotten more and more restrictive to just a very certain subset of office jokes, but has gotten meaner over the years. Cause now it's like, you know, he's gotten full on and like, oh, Dilbert really hates women. I mean, more and more all the time. So, you know, so I just wonder, like, I feel like if I were a cartoonist, you know, like you look at some of these other cartoons and you can see how they challenge themselves and, you know, they push themselves to improve in their medium, to deliver a joke better, faster, you know, with more zip and zim. And then you look at Scott Adams, who's just like, hey, the money's coming in, whatever, off to the golf course or whatever thing that I like that's, you know.
Talk to my cat.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to go talk to my cat that lives in the part of my house that's shaped like Dilbert's head. gonna go learn to teach myself to talk again while eating a dill burrito and fucking my underage Ukraine import wife or whatever he does. I don't know. But
I did think it was pretty funny that he said, I'm not somebody who needs a lot. It's like, oh, the guy who lives in a house shaped like his cartoon character's head doesn't need a lot.
I don't need a lot. Just my rocket powered car, my solid gold house. But I'm just saying, it's like, I feel like as another cartoonist, you would kind of look at that and just be like, you know what I mean? Like, you can kind of suss out a hack. And I feel like, you know, that's kind of the main thing. That's the main tell. It's just that, like, Dilbert, it does not get better. It only gets worse, you know? And it's, maybe I'm being unfair to Dilbert because, you know, I don't like Scott Adams personally, but I do feel like Dilbert had so.
Do you think that you would like Dilbert better if someone else replaced him?
I mean, I assume if someone else replaced him, Dilbert, the comic strip would also change, though, you know.
Presumably,
like
if someone could tell better jokes.
Like if a non Scott Adams was doing the exact same comic at this point, like, yeah. But I mean, like, if someone took over and brought back early Dilbert, like Bob the Dinosaur and all that shit, like, you know, maybe it would, maybe I, you know, look at it again.
If nothing else, it would get my attention.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, as it is, it's just like, yeah, he's, you know, he's not really a cartoonist. Like, he just seems to, like, again, he's an engineer who just kind of lucked into a cash cow. And you can really see the difference, because all these other people, I think, are all people who, you know, really wanted to be cartoonists, sometimes from a very young age.
We've often talked about how Gary Larson has a sort of happy to be here energy, but, and you would think that Scott Adams would have that, but no, Scott Adams is like, you know, it's about time. Hurry up.
Yeah. He's got engineer brain is his problem. Mm-hmm. Like, Gary Larson had music store clerk brain, which is much better. All right. So Scott Adams, let's see who else we got in this thing.
The aforementioned Hillary Price. I don't know if Rhymes with Orange has ever been in my comics page, but I like the ones that I've that are shown on this page. Hillary Price herself kind of resembles Yardley Smith.
Yeah, you know, I did not know anything about Rhymes with Orange other than that it exists, and it's kind of one of those comics. It's like, it's got no recurring characters, but it's not a one panel. It's an actual strip, which is kind of weird. And I've always thought of Hillary Price as one of those, you know, comics come lately, because I think she was just getting started as I was no longer really, you know, reading comics as diligently as I used to.
Yes. But I stopped reading the comics every morning when I graduated from high school, and I didn't have to wake up in the morning anymore.
I mean, this is very unfair, but at the time I kind of thought of her as like, oh, okay. Like, I guess Kathy is getting kind of long in the tooth, so they got to hire a new like woman, you know, because there are not,
so you thought of her
there
as being
not
like
a
six
lot of
chicks.
Women. Oh, sorry. Oh, six chicks. Yeah. That's one. I forgot. Actually, I think I might be mixing up Rhymes with Orange with Six Chicks.
Yeah, Rhymes with Orange is more of a, it's a Far Side in strip shape, kind of like Frank and Ernest. Oh, we don't see the Frank and Ernest guy in this.
Oh, he might not have been around anymore at this point.
I don't know. I'm not sure what the history of Frank and Ernest is.
Well, let's look up Frank and Ernest. Let's see. Frankandernest.com. Launch date, 1972. So Bob Thaves, the original cartoonist, is no longer with us, but his son has taken over production of the strip. Thaves died in 2006, so he was no longer with us when this documentary was presumably made. But I am being very unfair to Hillary Bryce here, you know, talking about how I used to think of her comic when back in the day. Every time I've seen, you know, Rhymes with Orange, it's actually, you know, pretty amusing. I think it's not like the name Rhymes with Orange makes me think it should be a lot zanier than it really is. It feels like it should be much more like Bizarro.
Yeah.
But it's kind of more like I don't know. It's got Sylvia vibes in some way to me. It's a little
Sylvia?
More sedate.
The old lady?
Sylvia. Oh, maybe I'm not.
Oh, no, that's
Sylvia.
Maxine. No.
Maxine, thank you. That's the one I'm thinking of. The greeting card, the old lady in the greeting cards.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of greeting. There's a greeting card vibe to Rhymes with Orange that I can't quite explain. I think because it's, but you know, it's definitely. But the art has a little bit of. I think she even says, Shel Silverstein is an inspiration, doesn't she?
Yeah, I can see that.
I can see that, though. I was actually thinking her art reminds me a lot more of not Shel Silverstein, but the Shrek guy.
William Stieg. Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely see a little bit of William Stieg, a little bit of Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. No, that is William Stieg. Okay, yeah.
That's William Stieg. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I actually also, I think she was really interesting in this documentary, or Hillary Price. She's really got like some interesting insights into like the craft of cartooning.
Yeah, actually I think she's one of the MVPs in this.
Yeah. I think she's one of those people who, like, you know, I'm short shrifting her because she was born too late, but I think probably, like, honestly, if this comic had come out like a few years earlier, I probably would have considered this, you know, one of the better ones of the, you know, of my late childhood.
Hey, this is Mike. So Ethan and I talked so much about the folks behind the funnies that we're actually going to get 3 episodes out of it this time. So join us next week for a continuation of The Folks Behind the Funnies.